Coming up, what it's like to run Mount Marathon as a 7-year-old. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for July 4th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, another change in the justice system, this time around posting bail.
People were being held in custody and in jail simply because they were poor.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
The 91st annual Mount Marathon race is over. 27-year-old David Norris of Anchorage won the men's race for the second time, finishing after 42 minutes and 13 seconds. Jessica Yeaton, also of Anchorage, won the women's race with a time of 51 minutes and 30 seconds. The course has been touted as one of the most difficult races in the world, but it's not just for adults in their prime. Alaska Public Media's Aaron McKinstry found out how some of the junior racers fared.
It's the night before the race, and families fill the cafeteria of Seward High School for a pasta dinner. The fundraiser is a good chance for runners to fill up on carbs before they burn them all off going up the mountain. Soon-to-be 12-year-old Tali Novakovic steps away from the food and into the evening heat.
So what's that bag?
It's a Mount Marathon race bag. So, yeah, it's like has my bib in it and stuff for the race.
Novakovic pulls out the number 26. Race day is her birthday, and it'll be her sixth time competing. The first time, she was just 7, the cutoff age.
It was cool because when I was racing on the podium, someone said that I was the youngest person to ever do it.
So. Novakovic is mostly worried about tomorrow's heat.
So there's, like, trees at the beginning of it and, like, halfway through, and then after that, it's like all out of the trees, and so it's going to be really hot.
The bottom half, it feels sort of like a steam room or a jungle because you're covered in trees.
That's Novakovic's mom, Tiffany Bird. She and her husband both run Mount Marathon, and 3 of their 4 kids do the junior race every year. Even though those younger than 18 turn around at the halfway point, a lot of the dangerous stuff is at the beginning when the kids scramble up a cliff.
Other kids can kick rocks loose. And so one year she said a big rock flew right past her shoulder, and things like that are always on my mind. So they race first in the morning, and I'm always really glad when they're done.
It one time hit me in the shoulder, but I was 8, and so I cried and then like took a break for a second, and then I just kept going. But yeah, it was not that bad.
Bird says she and her husband always take the kids up the mountain several times ahead of the race each year, but it's still nerve-wracking. The course can be different from year to year depending on weather. At 8 in the morning, it's already around 64 degrees when I start trekking up the mountain. I'm taking an old Jeep road to avoid the cliffs, and I'm still exhausted. It's hard to believe a 7-year-old can make it up without whining to their parents.
So, we're taking the easy way up, and I'm already out of breath.
At 9 a.m., the young runners lined up at the finish line, looking like ants down below. And then it starts. It takes the first runners less than half the time it took me to get to the turnaround point. They round a bend out of the woods, run around the post.
121! 242!
Kids gasp for air and gulp water. Novakovic shows up in the middle of the pack. She stops for a short breath, then joins the others, who are stumbling back down a long slope of scree. Clouds of dust and rocks kick up behind them. She says she always looks forward to finishing.
You feel really good inside. Well, you kind of feel like you're going to throw up, but but you feel good inside because you did the whole entire race, and yeah.
The boys' winner, Michael Connolly, finished in just under 27 minutes this year. Kendall Kramer won the girls' race with a time of 34.05. Novakovic cut 5 minutes off her best time. She looks forward to running the senior race someday, but for now, it's time to celebrate her birthday. In Seward, I'm Erin McKinstry.
The Mount Marathon race isn't the only big athletic event in the state this summer. Over the weekend, Haines hosted athletes from Alaska, Canada, and the Lower 48 for the second annual Chilkat Challenge Triathlon. During the race, competitors paddle, cycle, and run a nearly 40-mile course through the Chilkat Valley. KHNS's Henry Lisha reports.
Supporters cheer as competitors cross the finish line in front of a backdrop of white peaks and blue glaciers. The athletes have covered many miles by boat, bike, and foot to get to the Chilkat State Park. The triathlon starts in Mosquito Lake, approximately 30 miles north of the Haines town site. From there, competitors paddle 8 miles down the Chilkat River in kayaks or on paddleboards. Once they reach the shore, racers mount bikes for a 22-mile ride down the Haines Highway to Fort Seward. At the fort, the athletes begin the final 8.5-mile run to Chilkat State Park. Race Marshal Gershon Cohen says that the route is supposed to highlight the importance of the Chilkat as a natural resource and recreational site.
You know, everybody knows that we get food out of it, and everybody knows that it provides a lot of jobs for the community. It also provides tremendous recreational opportunities for the community, and we wanted to celebrate that. So we came up with the idea of having this race that's all along the river, in the river, or along the river the whole way.
Juneau residents Adam Moser and Alicia Fallberg of teams A Ablaze finished the race first with a time of 3 hours and 30 minutes. They are the reigning team champions of the Chilkat Challenge. Fallberg rode in the cycling portion of the triathlon. In spite of the difficult road conditions due to construction on the Haines Highway, she says she was well prepared.
I trained a little bit harder this year, so the gravel section was kind of sketchy, but we made it through. And we did the Kluane bike race 2 weeks ago, too, so we had been training for that, and that is helpful.
Justin Dorn of Juneau won the men's solo race with a time of 3 hours and 34 minutes. He was followed by Chris Muse of Haines and Alex Lynette of Skagway. Haines residents took the top 3 spots for the women's solo race. Alexanne Goodman finished in 3 hours and 51 minutes, followed by Kayla Brewer and Alyssa Besky. Goodman competed in the triathlon last year on a team. When asked what the most difficult portion of the event was this year, Goodman said the final stretch was extremely challenging.
They extended it by about 3 miles, and the last 3 miles are basically all uphill on a gravel road. So because the terrain changes and your legs are jelly, it is painful.
54 people completed the triathlon on Sunday, up from about 40 competitors last year. In Haines, I'm Henry Lisha.
For the second time in 6 months, there's a change coming in how defendants awaiting trial must post bail. As of January, most Alaskans charged with misdemeanor offenses didn't have to post cash bail in order to be released from jail. But due to a new change in state law, this measure is being reversed. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman talked with the state's top prosecutor and public defender about what the policy switch could mean.
The change in January was part of a law aimed at overhauling the state's criminal justice system. When it came to posting bail, it took discretion away from judges.
People were being held in custody and in jail simply because they were poor.
That's Alaska Public Defender Quinlan Steiner. He says judges were making decisions that had little to do with whether or not people were likely to show up for their court hearings. The new system gives each defendant a score with 2 components, how likely they are to violate the conditions of release and to commit new offenses. The score is based on publicly available information, like how many times they failed to appear at hearings or their number of arrests during the past 5 years. Those with low scores were considered low risk. Judges were required to release people charged with most misdemeanors without cash bail. But the lack of judicial discretion raised concerns for police, prosecutors, and ultimately the legislature. It passed a new law, which Governor Bill Walker signed June 14th, that says judges again can decide whether to require cash bail. John Skidmore directs criminal prosecutions for the state of Alaska. He says other states have used scores to set bail.
What no state did, other than the state of Alaska, was to make it mandatory that the risk assessment tool absolutely controlled the judge's discretion.
Skidmore says allowing judges discretion is essential.
There are certain people who pose a greater risk and therefore should be held in jail under greater or harsher conditions until pretrial or until they can appropriately set a reasonable bail.
Skidmore says it's important to make adjustments over time to what information judges can use to set bail. But he says the decision-making power should remain with the judge.
To tie somebody's hands and to say it will always be one way and not the other is just short-sighted, and I don't think is really focusing on reality, which is these decisions have to be made on a case-by-case basis.
Steiner, the public defender, says the courts must ensure that the latest change is applied in an even-handed way so that it doesn't repeat the mistakes the state made in the past.
The key is that it be applied across the board in a similar manner.
He says there's evidence that even small differences in the amount of time defendants spend in jail can increase their chances of committing new offenses.
With delay and increased incarceration, you sever people from the positive aspects of their life. They may lose their job, they may lose their apartment, they may lose an ability to care for their children. That can all occur with very short periods of incarceration. And what the data showed was even 24 hours, a 24-hour delay increases the likelihood that your rate of recidivism will go up.
Both Steiner and Prosecutor Skidmore agree that the state should continue to assess the outcomes from the changes. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how two unexpected deaths affected fishing in a rural Alaska community.
People that respect what other families are going through, they'll go ahead and stay behind themselves.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnosis and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
Over the weekend, a vandal ransacked an Anchorage school, causing at least $100,000 in damages. That's according to the Anchorage Police Department, who say they responded to an alarm call late Saturday night at Alpen Glow Elementary in Eagle River.
The damage inside the school was quite massive.
Renee Oystad is a spokesperson for APD and says officers arrived at the school to find two broken exterior windows.
Multiple classrooms were entered and vandalized. There were multiple holes put into the interior walls and windows. There was a lot of equipment damage, to include computers, projectors, printers. Several fire extinguishers were deployed. Damage is initially estimated to be at least $100,000.
Almost two dozen iPads were also smashed. On Tuesday afternoon, APD announced it had identified the suspected perpetrator based on evidence gathered from the building. Because the suspect is a minor, police have not identified him, but say charges have been sent to the Department of Juvenile Justice. Oystad says vandalism targeting schools increases during the summer. Mark Begich says he wouldn't be running for governor if he didn't think he could win. Despite that, the Democrat and former U.S. senator acknowledges the angst some have about his run for Alaska governor. The race is expected to split three ways between Begich, independent Governor Bill Walker, and the eventual Republican nominee. In 2014, Democrats backed a so-called unity ticket that featured Walker and Democrat Byron Mallott to beat Republican Governor Sean Parnell. Democrats changed their rules to let independents run in the primary, which Walker flirted with doing, but he opted to bypass the primary when it became apparent that Begich would enter the race for Alaska's governor. A new study looks at how vulnerable marine mammals are to increased traffic in the Arctic. As sea ice cover has decreased in recent decades, there has been an increase in the number of vessels that pass through Arctic waters. And with more ice loss predicted in the years ahead, there's potential for even more ship traffic. The researchers looked at seven different marine mammal species throughout the Arctic and focused on the month of September, when sea ice extent is at its lowest. In Alaska specifically, bowhead whales got the highest vulnerability rating, partly due to the fact that their fall migration crosses the two main Arctic shipping routes in the Chukchi Sea. Donna Hauser is the lead author of the study. She says certain aspects of bowhead whale behavior makes them especially vulnerable to ship traffic.
Things like slow speeds, they spend a lot of time at the surface, particularly when they're foraging, and so are more likely to potentially actually get hit by a vessel.
Hauser says she hopes the study may be useful in creating guidelines for vessel traffic in the future.
We could aim to develop some mitigation strategies that would help ships avoid key habitats, adjust their timing, take into account certain migration routes and times, as well as make some efforts to minimize sound disturbance, such as by changing vessel speeds.
In May, the International Maritime Organization established the first international guidelines for vessel traffic in the Bering Strait. Those guidelines take marine mammal safety into account, as well as other natural hazards relating to climate change. Hauser says this new study gives an opportunity to build on those efforts. A carbon tax could move forward on Washington state ballots this year. 2 years ago, Washington voters rejected a different carbon tax measure. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins of the Northwest News Network says that proposal didn't garner the support of a broad coalition. But this one is different.
What makes this different is that this carbon fee proposal is backed by a very powerful coalition of labor, environmental, and tribal groups. So there is a lot of power, a lot of money, and a lot of unanimity behind this particular proposal, whereas in the past we've seen split views on whether it was the right approach. So that's what makes this different.
Financial supporters of the carbon fee include the Nature Conservancy, the Washington Environmental Council, and the Washington State Labor Council. Oil companies are poised to fund an opposition campaign. Golden Valley Electric Association restarted and briefly operated the boiler of its coal-fired Healy 2 power plant during a test run Monday. Gary Betzel is Golden Valley's vice president of operations and power supply. He said Tuesday that crews had fired up the boiler again.
It ran for several hours yesterday. It's back running again now.
That's the first time that Golden Valley has restarted the boiler since November 2016. That's when a small explosion halted the last effort to restart the 50-megawatt plant in Healy. The blast caused about $1 million in damage to the system. Another stronger blast in March 2017 again halted a restart effort. But Betzel says the new fuel system seems to be working well.
We're impressed with what we have, and I think we've got tried and proven technology in the building.
Betzel says a few glitches arose during the tests, but nothing serious. If all goes according to plan, Healy 2 will be burning coal only by September 1st.
In the not-too-distant future, we'll start bringing in some coal. And as you bring coal in, you take oil out until you finally transition all the way to nothing but coal.
For years, Golden Valley's board of directors has promoted using more coal to generate electricity. It's a cheap fuel that will help keep people's monthly electricity bills from rising, they say. The plant will be fueled by Usabelli Coal Mine, which is headquartered in Healy.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
After months of negotiations, the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium and Wrangell Medical Center have struck an official agreement. The tribal nonprofit will take over the city-owned hospital and build a new facility within the next 4 years. This comes after the city's assembly and SEARCH's board of directors approved the binding agreement. KSTK's June Leffler has more.
Both parties announced that SEARCH will assume the responsibilities and operations of Wrangell's Municipal Hospital by November of this year. Architects should wrap up hospital designs by March of next year, and construction should begin that summer. This comes after the city reached out to SEARCH saying the cash-strapped hospital could not sustain itself long-term. At its best, the hospital has about 30 days operating reserve available to pay for services and salaries. In the fall, that reserve dropped so low, the city wrote a last-minute line of credit for $250,000 to keep the hospital going. Robert Rang is the hospital's CEO.
We are losing money. We're past hemorrhaging. It's a downright poor financially. We can't go much longer.
Senior Vice President of Search, Dan Neumeister, says this is a win-win for the city and regional nonprofit.
Search's mission is to work in partnership with the communities it serves. And we have been really focused on that over the last 5 years.
As a larger regional organization, Search has more resources than the city-owned hospital. And as a tribal organization, Search gets higher federal reimbursement rates for patients on public insurance.
By us assuming responsibilities, it allows us to bring some of our expertise in managing the hospital as well as some of the financial acumen that we can.
Neumeister says the hospital will maintain its critical access status and long-term care facility with room for expansion of services down the road. It should cost about $30 million to build the new facility within the next 4 years. He also says no layoffs will occur in the transition, and employees will maintain their current level of compensation and benefits. The new hospital will be built on up to 19 acres adjacent to Search's current clinic. With reporting from Robert Woolsey in Sitka, I'm June Leffler in Wrangell.
After an intensive search yesterday, a 13-year-old girl was found safe on shore after her kayak capsized in Shelikof Bay, about 15 miles from Sitka. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has the story.
According to Lieutenant Lance Ewers, police in Sitka were called at about 1:30 in the afternoon by a mother who had received an emergency text from her sister and brother-in-law who were camping at North Beach Cabin with her child, the couple's 13-year-old niece. The couple reported seeing the girl's kayak flip in Shelikof Bay on the outer coast of Kruzoff Island. They were in a double kayak themselves and quickly found their niece's boat, but the girl herself was missing. An Air Station Sitka helicopter was already airborne when the call came in. The helicopter diverted to Shelikof Bay and picked up the girl's aunt to aid in the search. A hasty team from Sitka Search and Rescue, including divers and police, made the 15-mile trip to Shelikof Bay. A boat from the Alaska State Troopers was also prepared to join the search, along with a private boat from an all-terrain vehicle concession on Kruzoff Island. The Coast Guard helicopter finally spotted the girl on shore near Port Mary, attempting to hike the 2 miles back to North Beach. She was hoisted aboard and delivered wet, but safe, back to the cabin along with her aunt. With temperatures in the 70s, Lieutenant Ewers was thankful for the warm weather. He commended the swift action of everyone involved in the search. Between drowning, bears, or a broken ankle, this could have been so much worse, he said. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Two families in Kasigluk lost loved ones last month. The death stopped many from going fishing for the food they need for the winter. In response, state and federal fishery managers teamed up to deliver salmon to the two families in mid-June. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur was with one of the families during a wake after the fish arrived.
Cassandra Tinker was killed by a hit-and-run driver on the streets of Anchorage on the morning of Saturday, June 16th. Word of her death reached Kasigluk during the second salmon fishing opening on the Kuskokwim River during a year of tight restrictions. Mary Alice Tinker is Cassandra Tinker's mother.
We were looking forward for Saturday to cut more fish. And that's the day that we heard about Cassandra's passing.
It's customary for Yupiat not to fish when there's a body in the community.
No time for them to watch their fish.
Balasia Tinker is Cassandra's aunt.
People that respect what other families are going through, they'll go ahead and stay behind themselves.
Cassandra was 23 years old. On the day she died, there had been another young person's funeral in Kasigluk, Misha Charles.
Losing the young generation at such an early age, it hurts.
In the house, they begin to cut the fish. The salmon was harvested by the state and delivered by the feds. Xenia Nicarai is Mary Alice's mother and Cassandra's grandmother. She looks on as another one of her daughters slices the fish.
Four kings, and four chums.
Me and my family love eating fish, especially king salmon.
While Mary Alice's sister and neighbor put the fish away, Xenia talks about Cassandra, the grandchild who is laid on the floor in the living room. She's dressed in Russian Orthodox ritual. A cloth lies across her forehead. A white shroud with an image of the crucified Christ covers her from the neck down.
When God wants to take our loved ones, He takes them, even they're small. Everybody have time to live and time to die.
Right now we're waiting. They started working on her casket yesterday, so hopefully it'll be done by tonight.
She was an awesome granddaughter. She was a comedian to everybody. She will be greatly missed.
The house fills with more people. Almost everyone is related. People go to Cassandra and kiss her bruised cheeks. At her feet lies a wreath of purple and white flowers. At her head is another wreath. On her chest sits a cross and an icon that people also kneel and kiss.
Are you going to have something to eat?
Yeah, I will. I'd love to.
A mother walks in holding a four-day-old baby girl. Twyla George is Cassandra's cousin. She chose Cassandra's Yupik name for the baby.
Gittuk. We don't pick out names only after they're born. And she was born exactly 27 hours after Cassandra's death.
The house holds that mixture of grief and fellowship particular to a wake. Grief for the life lost and joy in the reunion of family and friends, some who've flown in. Many bring food. Grandma Xenia gives them each a hug and they set down their dish.
The best food ever. Fish, moose, seal soup, rice.
As the wake progresses, some turn their thoughts to the driver of the truck hundreds of miles away who took the life of this 23-year-old woman just as the salmon began swimming up the Kuskokwim River.
I wish that whoever bumped her can just turn him or herself in and just get it over with, I guess. And admit they did this.
Police have posted a picture of the pickup and continue their investigation. In Kasigluk, Cassandra's body was laid to rest the day after the wake. In Kasigluk, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Aaron McKinstry in Seward, Henry Alicia in Keynes, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Ravenna Koenig and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Austin Jenkins in Olympia, June Leffler in Wrangell, Rob Woolsey in Sitka, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Kasigluk. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wes Early is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great 4th of July.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Stronghearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.